Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Dr. Richard DeVoe, who is a professor of statistics at Williams College. He holds degrees in civil engineering, mathematics, dance education, and statistics. He studied at Stanford with Percy Diaconis. Before Williams, Dick taught at the Wharton School and the Engineering School at Princeton and has been all over the place, and particularly in France, with some of the most prestigious institutions in that country. DeVoe has won numerous teaching awards, including a Lifetime Award for Dedication and Excellence in Teaching from the Engineering Council at Princeton. This summer, he was named the C. Carlisle and Margaret Tippett Professor of Statistics at Williams College. Dick has been a consultant for nearly 30 years for such Fortune 500 companies as Hewlett-Packard, Alcoa, American Express, Bank One, GlaxoSmithKline, DuPont, Pillsbury, Rome, and Haas, and Ernst & Young, among many others. He's co-author with Paul Vellman and David Bach of the critically acclaimed textbooks Intro Stats, Stats Modeling the World, and Stats Data and Models, and with Noreen Sharp and Paul Vellman of the books Business Statistics and Business Statistics of First Course, all published by Pearson. He's currently working on three new books on statistics, analytics, and big data. His hobbies include cycling, swimming, singing, barbershop, doo-wop, and classical. He was the founding member and bass for the Williams doo-wop group, The Diminished Faculty. He is the father of four, two boys, two girls, ages 24, 22, 20, and 18. Welcome, Dick DeVoe.
Thank you, Helen.
Dick, you're here because of the crisis that this country is facing on data mining. It seems that every day we hear something else. We hear that the U.S. Postal Service is taking a picture of every piece of mail that goes through the post office. We are hearing that people have stolen mass amounts of data from companies that ought to know better. And the question I have for you to start with is it hopeless?
Is it hopeless? What a great question. Well, first of all, you said data mining crisis. I think it's more of a data mining evolution. I think we've been ramping up to this for 20, 30 years. It's incremental creep, and the bigger we get, the bigger the mistakes, the bigger the problems. We're talking about the post offices. As you just said, this is news to me, but they're photographing every piece of mail, and yet there's still mail that's lost all the time. Neighbor was telling me they sent something to Laos, and they called customs, they called the post office, and finally the woman said, "If you've lost your mail, we can't help you." And this is really the situation with the NSA crisis that Congress is talking about, is that we're collecting a lot of information, but it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming. I mean, I think a lot of people are concerned that all their information is now under scrutiny by somebody. But if you think about how massive this data set is, it's overwhelming to the people who have to look at it. So,
well, who data mines?
Who data mines? Who doesn't data mine? Every piece of information we have in 2013 is digital now. And it's typical kinds of data that you know about. It's, you know, numeric data like addresses and how much you spent last week on your credit card, every transaction. But it's also now what we call unstructured data. It's video. It's all the cameras that we see. It's all the cameras from EasyPass. It's all this stuff. It's all out there. It's all digitizable. If it's not digital, phone calls, et cetera, are all digital. So this is a huge, huge amount of data. And that's why everybody wants to mine this.
And once you mine, what do you do with it?
Well, let me, if I can, go back to how I first got interested in data mining.
Sure.
Let's go back to the 80s. So I was consulting for what was then a small credit card company called First USA Bank, which has since been bought by others. It's long gone now. But they had a great idea, which was to steal everybody else's customers. They called it balance transfer. It was a brilliant idea. They just sent out notes to everybody saying, "We'll give you a toaster and lower your APR if you sign off your balance to us." And they got millions of customers suddenly. So the same guy who had this brilliant idea took me into his office one day, and he said, "Dick, here's what I want to do." He said, "We're collecting all this information." This is 1985. He said, "We're collecting all this information about all of our customers and what they're buying." He said, "I want to do two things. I want to put people into different kinds of buckets so that we can identify different kinds of shoppers. You know, we know there are impulse buyers. We know they're travelers. We know they're different kinds of people." He said, "That would be really interesting because we could market to them differently." He said, "But what I really want to do is look back and see patterns and see if we can anticipate what people want to buy before they know."
I love it. Sure.
And I thought, this is 1985. I said,
1 year after 1984.
1 year after 1984. Perfect. And the point is, we weren't ready to do it then. He didn't even have the data on discs. They were in a sitting in a warehouse somewhere.
Okay, but now here's a banker, and he wants to market.
Right.
What does he want to market?
Everything. I mean, he wants to increase use on his credit card. That's what he wants to do.
I see. So what he wants to do is to get people to buy, who might buy a mink coat before they know they want to buy a mink coat, to buy a mink coat.
Right. And to put it on his card.
And to put it on his card. And
exactly.
I understand the concept, but how does he get them to put it on his card with the marketing?
Well, he might give him incentives. He might send a note.
You buy a coat, you get a stole.
That's an expensive incentive. You might get double miles. I think that would be a cheaper incentive if you put it on this card when you're buying your mink. And, you know, somebody gets this and said, wow, I was thinking about buying a mink. How did they know? You know, and this is the trade-off.
How did they know it was a mink?
Because they looked at patterns and something led up to that. Now, that's a stretch, but there are patterns that we get. So
there might be something called the Scarsdale syndrome. So in other words,
diet?
Well, no, not exactly. But if they figure out that in order to live a certain lifestyle, you want a really good car, a really prestigious car, you'll probably also want a really prestigious mink coat unless somebody throws red paint on it,
right.
In which case you wouldn't want it.
That's absolutely right. And so on the other side of this, they're looking at patterns, as we know, for fraud. When you suddenly make a purchase that doesn't fit into your pattern, what happens? You get a call from
the bank.
The bank.
So if I go to Mexico, which I did, I get a call in Mexico from the bank saying, somebody's using your card in Mexico.
Right. So you were teasing me earlier about the number of courses I teach. Well, I taught a course at Williams last winter called The History, Geography, and Economics of the Wines of France, a travel course, for which I had to make arrangements to take 10 kids from Williams over to France so we could visit lots of chateaus and learn about making, marketing, selling wines. So while I was doing this, I'm sitting there in November making reservations, 10 rooms a night in various hotels around France, and I rented a bus. And suddenly, American Express just went crazy. They refused everything. I was getting phone calls from France saying, you know, this has been refused, this has been refused. And they, of course, said they were trying to protect me.
Right.
Well, I know who they were trying to protect.
Yeah, them.
Them. Right.
So you were furious.
I was very mad because I was under time pressure to get these things, and these rooms are disappearing.
Well, did you call and say, listen, I'm an expert. I know exactly what you guys are doing.
I said exactly that. And they said, we don't care.
They said,
our algorithm says,
that sounds
we're
right.
Sorry. But, you know, okay, now that we know, we'll approve it. But my question was, how many criminals rent buses with drivers to go around France? I mean, I really thought if somebody had looked at this, and this is my point, is that people aren't looking at this. People aren't examining everything that I do and making judgments. It's algorithms that flag these things, and then somebody reads a screen and then says, you got to do this, or it's automatic.
So just the other day, speaking of France, and maybe this is a non sequitur, I don't think so, one of the greatest jewel heists in history was committed. And so I'm beginning to think, if somebody puts $50 million of jewels in a hotel room, someone is going to figure out how to grab it, which they did. Now, I am of equal certainty that with the aggregation of this data, that you're going to find people saying crooks, whether they're in Bulgaria or whether they're in Cambodia or wherever else, because this is now an international undertaking, are going to figure out a way to steal the data.
Well, this
is there any way out of it? Because you're a consultant, you make a lot of money, you go around, you say to these guys, here's what to do, not to have that happen, right?
Well, I'm not a security consultant.
Yes.
There are people who spend their lives worrying about the security aspects of this, including my son, who's working for a startup in Manhattan now. He's a computer scientist who studies security issues.
But every day I get another update on one of my programs, because clearly the companies, the computer companies, have people working full time, matching wits with the crooks to try to figure out how to get there before the crooks do.
Right. And we've been doing this in lots of realms for years. I mean, anytime we have fraud possibilities, we have people who are developing algorithms to break the system and then algorithms to protect the system, and they're racing against each other. And it's the same thing, it's just on a bigger scale, because as Tom Friedman said, the flattening of the world has now let everybody in. Everybody can access this stuff. So we've got wonderful democracy for crooks all around the world. They can all get into this and all play the game. It's
so,
a race.
So how bad is it?
Well, there's this story that came out about how many credit card IDs did they steal? It was in the hundreds of millions. That's bad.
Well, that's interesting, because every time I read the paper and somebody says, some bank or other has told its people that hundreds of millions of names have been, but my bank account, which I check daily,
right,
has not been violated, even though I may have been on one of those lists of the 100 million.
Right.
So how much do we have to worry about?
Well, I think that the smart thing is to not be obsessively worried about it, but to be vigilant, as you said. I mean, what you should do is check your transactions regularly. And there's some that are really insidious. I mean, there's some where they just steal your card and then suddenly they're crazy charges and it will shut down.
Sure.
I mean, we know about those. But the more insidious ones are perhaps you went to an internet site and you clicked some box or you failed to click some box and now there's a $2.99 charge every month or so. And lots of people don't notice $2.99 charges. But $2.99 charges times several million, suddenly we're talking about some real money. And those are very tough to find and to get off. And one of the big concerns is this opt-in, opt-out switch that's happening. You know, some places you have to check a box to be included, but in other places you have to check a box not to be included, and it's not uniform.
I have a colleague who told me a long time ago, I used to call him in here, he worked here, he doesn't work here anymore, his choice, and I'd say to him, well, should I click the I don't want to get your stuff? He said, absolutely not.
His stuff? Yeah.
No. In other words, if I'm getting something from a company that says, if you don't want to get this, click below.
Right.
Well, maybe American Express might be doing that, compulsory. But he claimed that that was a trick to get you to give them your stuff.
I'm sure there are sites for which that's a, quote, trick in the sense that now they have confirmation that that's you, that's your email address, that's your IP address, all of that stuff. Yes, I never know what to do with those. And on the other hand, I try not to worry about it. I mean, we don't want junk mail, but how serious is it? I mean, there are a lot of serious problems in the country. And privacy, what is it? The president of Sun Microsystems said, privacy, just get over it.
Yeah.
That's one way to look at it. And I think it really splits on age. Now, for you and for me, this is a frightening thing to think about, is that about our data being out there and people being able to look at it. Talk to some 20-year-olds about this.
What do they say?
So my son, who I mentioned before, one of his first projects he was working on with some friends was an app on their iPhone, which would show where all their friends are 24/7.
Yeah, it's still there.
Yeah, and this would show them what they were doing, what tickets they had just bought so they could join them at the theater, and that all sounds great. Then you can imagine marketers jumping in on this and saying, oh, well, we know that Sam just bought this at Tower Records, which doesn't exist anymore. He just bought this. You could have gotten the same thing down the street for a dollar less. And I mean, this kind of information. And they think it's wonderful. They say, wow, isn't that cool? And we think, total panic.
Back in the day, I was an intern in a congressman's office. And I was there with him one day when he was talking to somebody on the phone. And he said, use the F word. He dropped an F-bomb. And he said, F-bomb you, J. Edgar Hoover. He said, I know you're listening.
Right.
And he was abscammed. They brought him into a...
Ooh, they were listening.
And they brought him into a room with, imagine a sheik who was offering him money, and they were looking through a two-way mirror. How much... I mean, the question then becomes, how much of this is so insidious that we don't have the sort of benign problem you were just describing,
right,
but where there are really people out to get us?
Yeah. Well, I think if you're somebody who's quite public or you're someone who has a history of terrorist activity, that you need to worry that there are people who are after you. That may be the case.
No, I'm not talking about them.
Yeah. But you're talking
the hell
about
with them.
You're talking about the general public.
Yes, I'm talking about us.
I think there's almost nothing to worry about.
Really?
I really do. I think there are a lot of problems in this country that are very serious. I think my worry about whether someone is watching my transactions, listening to my phone calls. As you know, I worked with the NSA for 5 summers. I worked without clearance on problems that they brought to a team at Stanford.
Like what?
Like they wouldn't say, here's a specific problem we want to solve. What they'd say instead is things like, we have a huge database with lots of rows, and most of those rows are okay, but some of them aren't, and we're going to label those with ones. And we've got lots of columns in the spreadsheet that will help you identify the ones from the zeros. Could you do that for us? You know, we know what they're after, but they would make them
I'm so
clean.
Sorry, and I'm so slow. You need to go a little bit further and tell me,
okay.
You say you know what they were after. I don't know what they were after.
So they have data on everybody.
Yeah.
They have some data on everybody. We know they have your address, your phone number.
Alan Shartow.
Your age. All of those things are public record, and they may have metadata They may have, this is the famous
like
metadata.
Yeah, go ahead.
They may have gone to Verizon and they may know all of the text messages you sent, not the content of the text messages.
Mm-hmm.
That's data. This is metadata. They know what number you sent it to, how big it was. They know the same thing with phone calls. So they have all these data. And now they have a flag to say whether you are a person of interest or not. And that's a very small number.
And that's the one.
That's the one.
Okay.
Okay. So what they want to do is have an automatic way, given this metadata and other demographic information, to be able to separate out the ones from the zeros. And of course, they'd love to do it perfectly, just like the American Express problem. When I make a transaction, is it a real one or a fraudulent one? And this is what we call in statistics type 1 and type 2 error, false positives and false negatives.
So the NSA, why don't you tell us a little about the NSA? You've been there, what, five summers?
Five summers, they come to Stanford, right?
They
I don't go to
Stanford.
Them.
And you are, of course, a distinguished professor at Williams College and an expert in your field. And the first thing I think everybody wants to know is, what is the NSA? We read about it every day in the Times. We don't know what it is.
It's the National Security Agency. I'm not enough of a historian to know when it was formed. Well, that's interesting about this contract. And let's go back again a few years. So the original contract was an Office of Naval Research contract at Stanford, which morphed into this summers with the NSA. And I don't know all of how that happened.
Well, how did you get the gig?
Well, that's a great question because I was actually, when I was at Princeton, I was on a WNET Channel 13 show about the pressures for young assistant professors in engineering to be on the Department of Defense payroll. And now,
I went
to school, approximately when you went to school, I was at
Not true, you're a kid. Yeah, go ahead.
I went to every moratorium, every protest march during the Vietnam War. I did all of this stuff, and I refused to take Department of Defense funding for years. And
I refused at the same time to smoke marijuana. Probably for the same reasons.
No comment.
I didn't know what was coming down the pike. Go ahead.
So I had never taken any Defense Department funding. And then after 9/11, I was approached by my colleagues at Stanford and said, they told me about the NSA project. And I said, well, I looked at the problems and I said, man, maybe I can help this 0-1 problem and related problems like that. So I started doing it. It was five summers that I was involved with it, and it was summer support, and we looked at these problems and we wrote papers about them. And it was actually, for me, it was an incredibly both interesting and productive. I got to solve problems with some of the smartest people in statistics, and they love to trade off Berkeley against Stanford.
This,
they love that. And so one of the summers, there was Leo Bryman came up with an algorithm that's really rocked the statistics world in solving one of these problems. So it was for us, it was great. And the problems were interesting.
Okay. But still, I want to bring you back to what is the NSA? We know the National Security Administration, but what we don't know is what their real charge is.
What their real charge is?
Yeah.
And how would I know that?
Because you're closer to them than we are, and because you're the expert, because that's why we invited you to be on the show.
It's a political question, right?
It's a question of this. How far do they go with what they get? You know, in other words, I told you the story about the congressman and J. Edgar Hoover for a reason.
Right.
Which was, if he was being listened to, and my congressman had, who I loved, by the way, had every reason to believe that they were. He was a liberal at a time when, you know, Hoover was running rampant and unstoppable and mm-hmm. the rest of it. If it did end up an abscam, in other words, somebody had to decide who was being invited into that motel room, the question then is, what does the NSA do with it? What are the limits? Now, we do have in this country, reading the stuff is fascinating, an emerging caucus of liberals and people from the far, far right who call themselves libertarians.
Right. The wing nuts.
And they call themselves the wing nuts.
Right.
Yeah. We're not doing it, although they may be, and who have gotten together, and they came within a few votes of bringing down the NSA program that we've all been talking about. So give us a sort of, you said it's a political question. Why don't you give us an idea of
the way it's developing? This is why I threw the question back to you, because this is exactly what should be happening. I mean, what I worry about, you asked me if I worried about privacy per se. What I worry about is what they call mission creep. That's what I worry about. And that's something that should be handled at the highest levels.
How do we know what the mission is? And how can we possibly know about the mission creep if we don't have a handle on what they're doing now?
that's exactly what Congress should be doing. These are people who have access to things that I don't have access to. Mm-hmm. I don't have clearance. So that's exactly what they should be doing. They should be debating this. I'm thrilled that Ed Snowden shed light on this problem because it is a balance. We all want to be safe and we all want to remain private.
Should Ed Snowden
be a trade-off?
Should Ed Snowden be put in jail?
I have no idea.
Okay, but I don't think so because so many people, half the Congress, are saying, God bless you. You know, you found that we are no longer respecting certain civil liberties that we thought we all that we thought we all had. So it's an easy one for me. I don't know. It's not for you.
It's a trade-off. I mean, when you sign something, say you've got clearance, you're signing something, I presume, that says you're not going to give this stuff away. And everybody's conscious. You have to decide when to break that trust. And I'm not in that situation. In fact, I insisted that I don't get clearance for that reason. I don't want to have to be in that position. There comes a point when something seems so heinous to you that you decide that you're going to break that trust, and apparently it did to him. Whether he should be prosecuted for that, that's not for me to judge.
We're talking to Richard DeVoe, who is a professor of statistics at Williams College and obviously a very brilliant man who has had a lot to do with the NSA and with thinking about the way in which all of this works. So I guess we're back to that central question. If we are developing all of this material and every American is going into this composite or this aggregate number, and you said before, if I don't want to put words in your mouth, but most Americans don't really have to worry because it's aggregate material and it's not individual. But there are a lot of us who don't believe that.
Well, it's individual.
Yeah,
it is individual. So let's talk about one thing, which is Ed Snowden is claiming that the NSA has phone calls. Now, my understanding was that the NSA collects metadata.
That's what they say.
That's what they say. And that's something that should be investigated because we have the FISC, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, that is supposed to be overseeing this whole process. That's their job. And if the NSA is going past what their mandate was, which you asked me what that was, and I said, I haven't read the mandate. But that's their job to look at, and if they're pushing that line, that's exactly what they should be doing. And that's why I'm thrilled that there's light being shed, because I don't think it was. I think, you know, as a neighbor of mine, Rob White at Williams, said, the problem with America is we want 100% security all the time.
Without question. Say it over and over again.
Yeah, and this is a problem, because you can't get that unless you want 1984.
Okay, so if you ask most Americans, okay, tell us, if you have a choice between total security and giving up all these civil liberties of yours, which will you do? And so far, the fulcrum has always landed on the we want security. And the other day, you may have seen Chris Christie, who was criticizing some of his Republican, quote, wing nuts, and saying, talk to me after the next 9/11 is basically what he's saying. And most Americans go, yeah, we got to stop that from happening. I'm not doing anything wrong. So what's wrong with it? You're walking down the street and the camera shows you with your girlfriend and not your wife. What's wrong with that?
Yeah. Well, the question is, what are they looking for? I mean, I go back to the IRS. You give a lot of information to the IRS and they're mandated by law to do certain things. When they go over that line, if they start looking at your purchases and start questioning your purchases.
They do it all the time.
Well, they question it if you claim that you do get a deduction, but they don't question why you did it. They don't say, oh, why did you buy so many of this? Maybe he's having an affair. That's not in their mandate. And if the NSA starts doing that, that's completely wrong. It's not what they're doing as far as I know, and it's not what they should be doing,
well,
clearly.
In all due respect to you, Richard, the fact is we don't really know what they're doing.
Of course. And so we have to decide whether we have enough oversight and whether we have some faith, because we can't be watching all the government agencies all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, the IRS just got in trouble for looking at certain groups. And that's the way the process works, isn't it? I mean, people who have power, I don't think I have to lecture you on this, right? Mm-hmm. You give them power, so what should we do? Not give them any power? Nobody has power? That's not going to work.
Okay.
It's a constant trade-off. I mean, you want to look at trade-offs. What about TSA? Let's talk about that. There was an op-ed editorial in the New York Times about TSA, and I said, thank goodness, it was about time somebody did it. I went to the train from Rensselaer to New York the other day, which a train I take often, and there was the TSA in the lobby at the train station. I was absolutely outraged. So I almost got into trouble.
These are the same TSAers we see in the airport.
In the airport.
They're checking you over.
They're at the train station. And I said to them, is this a new thing? You're going to be here all the time? They said, oh, no, this is just random. Mm-hmm. I thought, now, You want to talk about a waste of money? First of all, how many terrorist acts have we had on Amtrak in the last 100 years?
They would say, that's why we're here.
That's why we're here. So randomly picking a random Monday afternoon for a random train in Albany is a good use of our money?
You don't think they have a logarithm too, or an algorithm?
I don't think they do. Either one.
Okay.
I think that was a complete waste of money.
What are your students saying about all this?
What are my students saying about all of this besides trying to get through the course? I think this is one of the things that engages them. I think they like thinking about these trade-offs. And as I said, younger people have a completely different place that they make this trade-off than we do. I think their value on privacy is much less than ours.
Okay, so Anthony Weiner gets into a lot of trouble. This is where it gets interesting. And he's stupid. What a jerk. And he sends out sexually explicit messages. Well,
right.
You know, I could say that into this microphone, but I actually heard them. I had a colleague who told me about what these words were.
I know. I heard you this morning.
Yeah, but they're unbelievable. You could not use them on the radio without losing your license. I mean, it's
but he wasn't using them on the radio, as you pointed out.
But it's nothing that if you've ever read Playboy, Penthouse, or one of those places, you haven't seen before. But all of a sudden, he runs for mayor.
Right.
And all of a sudden, every bit of it emerges.
Right.
It's possible that the correspondent threw him in, but I don't think so. I think what happened was that somehow this flotsam and jetsam was floating around out there. So we don't know. No. If we're being controlled, I want you all to know that Richard DeVoe is shaking his head back and forth and saying, no, that's not what happened. But I'm telling you, with this data, somebody like the recent whistleblowers will find it and do something with it.
So let's look at this. It was not that he sent these texts out there and they were tracked randomly by somebody. The NSA wasn't saying, oh, look, we've been searching constantly for these words and these showed up and we're going to send this to a newspaper.
And you know this how? You already told us you don't have clearance. You're not at the top of it.
Because yeah. I don't think they have the capability of doing it, even if they wanted to.
You, sir, talked to me about going out to Stanford and working with the smartest scientists
right.
in the country.
And I know the problems they had.
Yes.
They're already overwhelmed by the problems that they were giving us. To be able to do what you're talking about, it's a little bit like, have you ever watched 24?
Hey, you know what? Well, my neighbor was in it. My friend wrote it. They built an atom bomb when an atom bomb couldn't be built.
Right.
They built a hydrogen bomb when it couldn't be built.
Right.
We used to have these massive computers, which are now inside of the same capacity in your laptop.
Right. And they still can't find the mail.
And they can do it. They can do it if they want to do it. So the real question is, what is the political will to do this?
That's the right question. I mean, of course, they can do any specific thing that you're talking about. You're absolutely right. They can go in, and if they have the text, if the texts are stored, if the phone call is stored, then somebody could go into that, and that's the concern about storing the phone calls, is that somebody could go in there and search digitally for a word, for something, and find something. Absolutely. My point is that this isn't going to happen to the average citizen at random because the amount of data is so
overwhelming. Okay, so let's forget about the average citizen. Let's take me.
Okay.
This is a pretty good idea. I fight with National Public Radio all the time. I don't like the allocation of scarce resources. I don't like the way they do it.
Okay.
And I'm always there to say something. How do I know I'm not the average person all of a sudden?
Right.
I've got an agenda which is different from those people who are trying to run public radio for the country and running it here from a station. So how do I know that when this thing happens, if you get a pain in the rear from somebody that you won't, I mean, there'll be people on the other side of the radio right now saying, you're screaming, hey, don't be paranoid, Shark Talk. I mean, there will be that. On the other hand, all of a sudden we find out that some of the stuff we've worried about all of our lives turns out to be true. How do we know that 1984 isn't here?
Well, I guess to be absolutely fair, we don't.
Yeah.
But you asked me about my opinion, and
no, I got your opinion.
Yeah.
And I'm delighted that you have it because it allows for a certain amount of debate with a distinguished Williams scholar. Okay, so the real question now before the public is, how much is data mining is going on? And I think we can pretty well agree it's universal.
All the time.
Okay. And then the next question is, when does it graduate to interference?
Right. So my mother-in-law refuses to buy anything on the internet with her credit card because she's sure that someone is going to watch that and then do something terrible to her because they'll know where she shops and what she buys, et cetera.
What do you mean terrible to her?
Well, I don't know.
Did she get murdered or something?
I don't know.
No.
She hasn't been explicit. She's
well,
just
I agree
fearful
with her. I see stuff in the middle of the night that I want to buy some steak knives or something like that. In the middle of the night, it comes on and says, you can't. This is not available anywhere except here. I won't do it. I'm not giving them my credit card.
Well, there you go. So you can do that, and you can be fearful. My point is that we got back to starting this conversation with what does the bank want? Does the bank want to track you down and do something terrible to you in the middle of the night because you bought the steak knife? No, they want to encourage you to buy more steak knives. That's what they're doing. That's what all these people really
do.
We're not talking about the criminals.
No, I'm not worried about them.
Okay.
Be people who are worried about it. I'm worried about the damn government. I mean, I don't want to be a wingnut either, but I'm worried that in the same way J. Edgar Hoover was known for assembling files on everybody from Martin Luther King, which we know in reflection and looking back, happened. I'm worried that if he started it back there with a couple of manila envelopes, what the hell has that agency done since that time?
Right. And if they're collecting phone calls, I think that's probably not in their purview. That's what the FISC is for, to do that.
But we
just look at that.
The FISC, go ahead and tell everybody what it is.
That's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court that was created when FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, was passed after 9/11. And their job is to
make sure that it's all kosher.
Right.
Except that the guys who get put on the FISA court, from what we hear, have pretty well said to the agencies of government owners, go right ahead and do whatever you want. And who do you think they appoint to sit on those FISA courts? A bunch of judges who are politically acceptable to the people who are appointing them.
Absolutely. And that's why I'm thrilled that there's light being shed on it, because we're having this debate now. And then that's the process. And we need to fix the process. I'm completely with you. I probably have a file this deep from what I told you from college. So I don't want this stuff collected. And phone calls, I don't think, are the right thing. I would be surprised if they are collecting phone calls, but if they are, they shouldn't be collecting
calls.
I know you are.
I would assume that people are listening to what people have to say.
Let's go to that. That's a great thing. How could people be listening to more than a billion conversations every day? How big a staff do you think they have?
You know what? I don't think they want my colleague David Gustina. But I think they might be interested in what I have to say. Let me tell you a story.
So now you're saying, okay, before your story, you're saying that there's a select percentage whom they're listening to all the time.
It's always been that way.
You're on the air all the time. They don't think they have enough. They want to hear more of you.
Oh, well I'm on the air and they may not like what I have to say. So they may decide. I'm just saying, look, for all of you who are sitting there thinking I'm a total paranoid, it's only partly true, is that, you know, there are ways when people get dangerous of handling. Let me tell you an interesting story. I'm now 72 years old. When I was 18, a sometimes girlfriend and I, she wanted to go to a YPSL, which was the lefty sort of semi-communist, I believe, socialist organization, and some speaker, and I went with her. We got home. We put down false names in the book. We got home, we both got letters the next day saying, thank you for attending, with our names on them.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's, over 55 years ago.
Right.
And here, we've graduated with something else.
Right.
My mother told me, don't go to 14th Street with Pete Seeger for the rally that they're going to have down there, because the FBI will be there. And I looked at her and said, oh, Mom, please, will you please stop that? She was absolutely right.
Yeah.
They were.
Yeah,
we know
there
it.
Were people. They were writing
I'm
down
saying
names.
If it started there, you think we're going backwards in terms of protecting people's rights? I don't think so.
What I think is the amount of data is so enormous that you would need a staff that would dwarf the current government to be following all of this stuff. Now, you're asking me, could there be abuses? Could there be people who have gone beyond what they're supposed to do and be trailing somebody? Absolutely. Of course there could. This is human nature. Of course there could. But can you get that from the metadata? Can you get that from the algorithms? Not likely. That's the difference. You're talking about, could somebody use this technology to really make someone's life miserable? Of course they could. Of course they could. They could before. They could in the 50s. This is just a digital version of that. But is that what's happening? I mean, I have no idea. You have no idea. You're paranoid. I'm not.
The only difference is, yes, but you're the expert and I'm not.
algorithms, not in the politics and not in the rest of what you're talking about.
Tell us a little bit more about the algorithms.
So what these algorithms do is they're trying to figure out, for example, in the 12 seconds that they have when you put your credit card down, whether that transaction is valid or not. That's what an algorithm tries to do.
Well, that's easy. That's an easy one. And that's the bank, and that's the company that wants to sell you stuff.
So now what is the NSA looking at? What they're looking at for one thing, one problem I loved that they explained to us was they have the following problem. They have hundreds of thousands of documents that come across their computers every day in about 147 different languages. They don't have the ability to store all those documents, nor to read them. So what they want to know is, can we develop an algorithm that tells us which are the most interesting
documents?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's a fascinating computer science statistics
problem. And what did you tell the Mac?
We said, we'll work on it.
And did you work on it?
Yeah, we worked on it.
And?
And we're working on it.
Still working.
It's a hard problem.
But they solve this every day in different ways. In other words,
they have to make choices every day.
Right. They have to make choices
because they don't have enough staff capacity, bandwidth to store, read, digest every phone call, every text message, whatever they're collecting. I'm not saying they are, but they don't have the capacity to look even the metadata. What we want them to do is to be looking at people who are under suspicion for legitimate reasons. That they're under suspicion for legitimate reasons.
I'm sorry, Dick, but every single time that we say that if you're innocent, you will not be subjected to the long arm of the law. We have seen abuses every time.
Yeah. Well, there are mistakes. And this is what
I'm not talking about mistakes.
I know you want to talk about abuses. I want to talk about mistakes.
All right.
As I said, I'm willing to give you abuses. When you say
I'm willing to give you abuses,
that's illegal.
That's what this is.
The abuses are illegal. So, I mean, what more can we do? We could shut down the NSA. We could say nobody should be able to collect any information on any citizen in the United States. But we talked about trade-offs. There are trade-offs. So if something is illegal, how much should we...
Okay. Well, that's interesting. So you were talking about just one whistleblower, Snowden. And now I believe I just read that Snowden said he's coming out with information in which he's going to say, now who knows whether this is right or not, that he's going to say that they do listen in on your phone calls.
And that's illegal. And that's if he has information and says that and that's illegal, then I think he should be a hero.
Well, we sure wouldn't want to put him in jail for that. No. In other words,
For being a hero. For pointing out something that's illegal. Absolutely. And that's the question.
It does seem to me that if Snowden is to be locked up and there is a great passion with the Justice Department and others to do this, that there's got to be a reason that passion is so great when you and I have both agreed that he has done the country a service. Haven't we?
Oh, it's great to be a political scientist.
Well, haven't we agreed on that? Did you say something like that?
I think there was an if before all of the things that I said, but...
Okay, all right.
If he has evidence that they did something illegal, then he should be qualified as a hero. You know, I don't know. If he's just violated his security agreement, then that's a different story. And that's, isn't that the question?
Well, it's a question we always deal with. We dealt with it with Daniel Ellsberg.
Exactly.
Who did a terrific thing for the country. There were those who said that when the Bay of Pigs was coming along, that John Kennedy would have been protected if we had more whistleblowers. And he said so himself, I believe, because, you know, they made a terrible error. So, you know, I happen to think you can't have a democracy without knowledge. And if you don't have knowledge of what's going on, and that includes everything that these guys at NSA are doing, then you can't have a democracy. Then you have something else.
Right. I completely agree. And at the same point, you have to have knowledge about the people in your country and whether if there's a threat, especially by foreign nationals, then you want to know that as well. And this is the trade-off that we're trying to figure out, right? I mean, everybody wants to be secure and private, and there are errors that are made. You're talking about abuses. I'm talking about errors. There are errors when I get the phone call from American Express saying, we canceled that bus. And I said, why did you cancel that bus? I need the bus. And there are going to be errors. I think too much random searching, too much data mining of people who are not under suspicion is going to lead to what we call false positives. And false positives are terrible. Drug testing. They can be devastating in drug testing,
could
a false positive.
Could
be the end of your life. And absolutely, the more we do random testing, we're going to always get false positives, and it's a terrible thing. So the question then is, how wide should this be? And this is why I'm so thrilled that there's a debate going on. Who are they looking at? The NSA should not be looking at the average citizen and watching what they do.
Richard DeVoe, let me ask you a question. Have you had a seminar on this question with your colleagues at Williams?
No.
And when you discuss this stuff with Williams, and you certainly will when you get back there, they're going to all start yelling at you.
I'm on sabbatical.
After they hear this, they'll call you up. And I mean, you know, it's a sort of liberal institution. I know many of the professors there one way or the other over the years. I get the feeling that, you know, the justification offered that the NSA will not use this for purposes of evil will be...
I am not saying that. Don't put those words in my mouth.
Okay, please.
What I'm saying is that I can't stop them from doing it, and I think we all should be stopping them from doing it, and that's why I'm thrilled that the Congress is looking at this. What you asked me at the beginning was, am I worried about this? That's a different question.
And your answer to that was not.
I'm more worried about driving over a bridge that's about to collapse.
Mm-hmm.
I'm much more worried about that. That's a real threat. That happens. People die. And we're not spending any money. I mean, I think there are lots of problems in the country that are really serious. And I'm sure there are abuses that are happening here, but this is just not one that I'm particularly worried about.
But you're a scientist. And I remember my bait, and you've written book after book on statistics and probability. And I remember my statistics course. And I'm telling you that the probability, I would argue, my hypothesis would be that the probability of the bridge collapsing underneath you is far less than the probability that one of these characters at NSA is going to use data in order to either deprive me of certain civil liberties that I have or not. And there we differ.
Right. There we absolutely differ, because I think the bridge one is orders of magnitude greater than the other. So that's where we differ. And that's why I don't worry and you do.
Tell me more. Tell me more about anything. Go ahead.
Well, I think it's interesting that you just turned this around and said that I'm going to get phone calls from my colleagues because suddenly I'm not portraying myself as liberal enough for Williams. I mean, I challenge you to out-liberal me.
Yeah, I know
where you are. I believe absolutely in civil liberties. And that's, again, why I think the people whose job it is, the Congress, the courts, should be who is supposed to control the NSA. That's who's doing it. And I think the more that the public sheds light on it, the better off we are. Do you want to get rid of the NSA?
Do I know?
Okay.
But I'm just fascinated by having this conversation with you, and I'm very pleased that you've agreed to do it. But the NSA and the FISA court are problematic for me.
Yeah.
I don't think that they put the judges on the FISA court who are going to say no. I think you
ought to write letters for that. I mean, I'm not writing letters.
Yeah, I'm interviewing you. I'm not writing letters. You're kidding. If I write them a letter, they'll know where I am. So
send them a text.
So they might know. What's this? They'll take a look. So in terms of our national obsession with data mining, should we be concerned that we're being manipulated as a philosophical question? I mean, I understand there are places that you walk into and they say, welcome, Dr. Shartok. Menswear is on the third floor.
Right.
And they know from the minute you walk in who you are, what you're interested in, what you most likely will.
Right.
Will,
and you gave all that information to them.
One way or the other.
Right.
Did I know I was giving them the information?
Well, that's the opt-in, opt-out question. But you did give them the information whether you knew it or not.
Go over that opt-in, opt-out for me one more time.
Which box did you or did you not check when you went to the website? When you went to the website, now you're thrilled when you go to the website that the little ads that you're getting actually are something that you want. You like that better than the random stuff.
That didn't happen just randomly. That happened because they know who I am.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that is something that you can either be concerned about or you can welcome. Depending on whether it benefits you or not. And it's a trade-off. I agree.
It's interesting. My wife and I have gone to this restaurant on Amsterdam Avenue in New York every once in a while when we're down there.
Mm-hmm.
And they give you a little card at the end of the meal and your satisfaction level. And
fidelity
then you write,
card.
And then you write down and they say, what's your birthday?
Yeah.
Every year, I'm getting all of this stuff, not only from that restaurant, but other restaurants, because they're trading this data about happy birthday, Alan.
Exactly.
Scary.
Right. Well, it's scary. So my colleague and friend, Andreas Wiegand, was the chief scientist at Amazon, and I love his perspective on all of this. He says, well, let me ask you a question. Do you have any windows in your house?
Indeed.
Do you keep the shades drawn all the time, or are they open?
Open.
So couldn't somebody be watching everything that you do?
Yes.
Okay. Now, do you worry about that?
No.
Oh, wait a minute.
I just sent out, we're spending a lot of money to have all the windows in the house cleaned.
So they can see better
what you're doing. Right.
But that's his point about data, is that, you know, we do have windows, and it is possible for somebody to abuse that. Somebody could be a little periscope in your window watching everything
that's
that
right.
you do.
That's right. And here's the issue. One day, a bunch of us here at 318 Central Avenue, we're looking out the window, and we see that in the building on the catty corner to us, there's a guy videotaping. Well, he's got a videotape machine. He's standing behind the videotape machine. He's videotaping us. So we marched. This is a long time ago. So we marched ourselves over there, or somebody did, and said, what the heck is going on up there? Why are you doing that? Machine disappears. We'll never know.
Right.
We'll never know what was happening, whether it was just some guy who was just doing this or somebody else. But they did it. And I'm saying, at least we knew by looking out the window that there was somebody doing that.
Only because you looked out the window right then.
That's right.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there's a lot of stuff going on. Look,
right.
you and the best scientists in America were over there in Stanford figuring out logarithms and algorithms and all the rest of it. And I don't know that we can look out the window and see you.
So here's Andres's point about all of this, is that because people are going to be looking at your data, one thing you want to do is make sure your data are correct. And what he's fighting for is access to your data. So, for example, if your credit score is wrong,
that's right.
What can you do about it? And he's advocating for more access for everybody to own their data. So at least we'd have some more control over it, be
sure.
able to clean it up, be able to do that. Our medical records.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go back to mentioning my son who's now working for ZocDoc. I don't know if ZocDoc's in Albany, but it's, you know, OpenTable.
Tell us about it.
You ever make a reservation on OpenTable?
Oh, OpenTable, yeah. It's a restaurant reservation.
Exactly. It has all the restaurants around, and you can select. ZocDoc is the same thing for doctors. And one thing they're trying to do is have you put your documents up there so when you go to the doctor, it's right there, and you don't have to fill out all the forms. You don't have to transfer
well,
all this stuff.
This is an inevitability in the United States, especially with the new healthcare laws that we're looking at, so that any doctor can access your records and not have to do the same damn tests over and over.
Right, and that'll be a great cost saving. So that's
the more benign
way of looking at data.
Also, maybe a reason you're not going to get a job somewhere. If, for example, somebody had HIV, you may not get a job.
And now you're talking about abuses of it. And, of course, as soon as the data are digitized, there are possibilities of abuses, but those are illegal. I gave this talk on data mining at the Cooley Law Review in Michigan. Why do the lawyers care about it? For exactly this reason. These are the people who should be worrying about protections, than worrying about what laws we need to protect citizens
from
this
kind of
abuses.
So what did you tell those people at Cooley? Don't worry?
I didn't tell them at all. I told them what the capabilities were, and I told them what the capabilities weren't.
As you knew it
as
at
I
that
knew
time.
It at the time. What else can I do? Right, exactly. Yeah. And I want to explain to them what these algorithms do, because I think people think they're much more powerful than they are. Again, I'm going to go back to 24, which we talked about a little while ago.
For all of you who are not up
the television
not
show,
up to
show that that ended a couple of years ago that apparently is going to come back for another season. But they have lots of references to data mining, and they're wonderfully fanciful. In all of them, Jack Bauer, the hero, needs some information in 10 seconds about a terrorist that he has a fuzzy videotape of that he's chasing at 80 miles an hour, and he uploads that to Chloe, who's at Central, and she types a few things in and says, you know, I need a few more seconds. He says, you don't have it, and she says, that's okay, I've got it. This is wonderful fantasy.
Okay. Assuming you think it's fantasy and I think it's
possible.
I think it's possible, right? That's a good word. How do we know that it won't? I mean, is there any doubt in your mind that we won't get there? We can have facial recognition. You could have a...
Oh, yeah. So let's talk about what's scary, right? I'm watching my son upload photos, and Facebook is recognizing all his friends and saying, weren't you here with so-and-so in Jamaica and et cetera?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that is scary. That scares me. Even he thought it was a little scary, and he's 20. So I agree. This capability that we have, the question is, all the kids sign up for this. They all do it. You know, when they click that little button, they opt into stuff. I'm not going to ask you if you have a Facebook account, but
I do.
Okay. If you go there and if you want to play the how many countries have I visited game, just pick one of them. Your friend says, oh, I've been to 72 countries. How many have you been to? And you click it. The first thing it says is, before you play this game, by the way, we're going to have to upload all of your information, all of your friends' information, all of your photos, all your birth certificates, all this information about from the restaurant, all of that stuff. And you might...
Too late.
Yeah, it's probably already there. And if you're 20 years old, you say, well, yeah, I want to play the game. Click. That's what's
up
there.
Or this other thing you were talking about, which unfortunately my son put on my computer called Where Are Your Friends?
Okay,
so
yeah.
There you
friend
go.
Finder,
same,
right.
same thing.
Right. And they're all there. So this is the world that we've opted for. And
I didn't actually opt for it. I just know it happened.
You didn't check the right box or uncheck it.
But there was no right box. I told you that because if I checked that box... My colleague here told me that they'll get that.
Right.
That's the way to get the information.
I think it's a great concern. I mean, I think that that the sharing of information is pervasive. It's everywhere. And as you absolutely said, the restaurants are all sharing it with each other. Facebook says they're never going to sell this information. They didn't say they weren't going to share it.
Yeah. You know,
or they buy somebody who's a marketing company and now it's their company. So they didn't have to sell it. They own it.
Interesting.
They're selling advertising. They're selling a lot of advertising. Their stock just jumped because of the amount of advertising.
But then when the Chinese government says to our companies like that, I don't know if this is one of them, you're not allowed to come into our country unless you listen to us and do what we want you to, that could be pretty scary too, because a lot of the stuff that we're getting over here, we're finding out are foreign governments that are looking at what we do over here. Let the witnesses know that the guy on the witness chair is shaking his head.
I'm not shaking my head. I don't know what you're talking about.
No, I'm talking about the fact that this data now is been uploaded to foreign governments who are not always our friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that they now have.
So they now know what toasters we want to buy.
Well, if you're going to limit it to toasters,
What about the United States doing surveillance on European governments?
Without question.
That wasn't very popular either.
No.
Right. And that wasn't about data mining.
No, without question. Okay. So let's look 5 years into the future. You're a scientist. The basis of science, although I get criticized when I say this, is often predictability. What do you predict?
I predict more of the same. I predict that we're going to get more and more targeted advertising to us. And I'm hoping that in some sense, the choices that we make, the marketing will take care of some of it. I mean, if we're really inundated with too much junk, that we will stop using that. I mean, that's how.
I don't know. I get 1,000 email messages a day
too.
Now. 1,000.
Yeah, that's awful.
And I write to say no. Put this in the rubbish heap.
Yeah. So we still
work.
Get phone calls, and yeah. we're on a no call list, and we still
sure.
get the phone calls. And somebody said, "Oh, well, we're not telemarketers." I can't remember exactly what words they said, but they said it didn't apply to them. And I said, "Well, take me off your list anyway." No, it's annoying. And that's the trade-off as a society that we have to decide. It is just getting worse. We're getting more and more ability to know who you are, what you like, et cetera. I mean, so a friend of mine had a condition that only he and his doctor knew about.
Yeah.
And he suddenly got ads to cure this particular thing.
Sure.
Now, how did that happen? Well, I can tell you how it happened.
Yeah, go ahead.
It happened because he probably went on WebMD or some other places and
exactly.
looked up this condition.
Sure.
And so they're going to look at that and send you stuff for it. So here's what's interesting. So let's get back to the bus and they're deciding that was a
sure.
fraudulent transaction. It wasn't somebody looking at that and saying, oh, this guy just rented a bus in France. I bet he's a criminal. It's an algorithm. So the same with WebMD. They're just going to send, every time you go to that page, they're going to send something that's related to that. It's not somebody sitting there saying, oh, isn't that interesting? So-and-so
has this
condition.
No, we know what that was. That was you're spending more money than you should be spending over there. But what happens when you start to get ads saying, so you want to rent a bus?
Right.
Which is going to happen next.
Right. And it could happen. And I could save $1,000 next time I do the course because I get an ad from some other bus company that said, oh, we have a better bus. This one actually has a bathroom on it. And I'll be thrilled. So that's the trade-off, right? Is whether we're thrilled or whether we're annoyed.
We're out of time. We've been talking with Professor Dick DeVoe, the C. Carlisle and Margaret Tippett Professor of Statistics at Williams College. Dick DeVoe, thank you so much for joining us today. I had a great time.
It was a lot of fun, Alan.
I'm Alan Chartok.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.